Since April of 1985, this is the DX Audio Service.
Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for February 2011. This is issue number 311. If you'd like to write to us, our address for the DX Audio Service is Post Office Box 473-251, Aurora, spelled A-U-R-O-R-A, Colorado, 80047-3251. Email address for general inquiries and subscription information is sales, S-A-L-E-S, at nrcdxas.org. My club email address is dxas at nrcdxas.org. Please change your address book to reflect these addresses. A yearly cassette subscription to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for U.S. Canadian members is $28. Tapes are sent via first-class mail, and you keep the cassettes. To subscribe or renew, make a check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that is mentioned, or you can log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using the PayPal credit card system. Or if you're on the Internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX audio service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal, and subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without assistance. Well, speaking of assistance, we do have some. With two new editors here that will be on the DX Audio Service, let me give you some information about them. First of all, Bruce Winkleman has been a radio listener, DXer, and a ham radio operator for many years, and a National Radio Club member since the early 70s with a couple of stretches of off time. Bruce strays into shortwave listening and DXing occasionally, but always comes back to his first love of broadcast band DX. Bruce is also active on the ham bands as Alpha Alpha 5 Charlie Oscar, that's AA5CO, primarily a CW DXer. 100 watts to a vertical is much more fun on CW than on single sideband. On a personal level, Bruce is 60 years old and a pharmacist in Tulsa, Oklahoma, working for a grocery pharmacy chain. Bruce has been married to Jeanette for 38-plus years. She's been wonderfully tolerant of wires across her backyard and antenna masts strapped to the house for years. Bruce and Jeanette have two sons, both married and living in North Carolina, and two beautiful granddaughters. And Bruce, I know that drill well with the antenna. Dave Alpert has been DXing since the mid-1960s, an NRC member off and on, and DX Audio Service subscriber and listener for the last few years. Dave has also been a member at various times of the International Radio Club of America, the Worldwide TV FM DX Association, NASWA, ODXA, CIDX, the old ASWLC, and SpeedX, and was a founder and editor-in-chief and publisher of the long-defunct Midwest DX Club in the late 60s to the early 70s. His DX interests spanned all aspects of the hobby. Dave is also a amateur radio operator with the call sign of Kilo Bravo 2 Lima Uniform Mike. That's KB2LUM. Broadcasting has been Dave's lifelong profession. Dave is currently a volunteer with the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service and has spent most of his last 30 years working for ABC News, and the last 10 as a correspondent based in Los Angeles. And Dave, we have a little treat for you when we do your column. Let's quickly address some news and notes. First of all, the sad news about Marvin Robbins. Word was received from Phil Robbins that his brother Marvin Robbins passed away from a short illness on December 18th in Ocala, Florida. Marvin hosted the National Radio Club Convention in Omaha in 1959 and was involved in starting the International Radio Club of America, or IRCA. Marv, by the way, was the sole survivor in a car accident in Macon, Missouri, with three other National Radio Club members on their way from Denver to Indianapolis for the National Radio Club Convention in 1962. The other National Radio Club members were Francis Nittler and Hal Wagner from Erie, Pennsylvania, and Carol Seth from Buffalo, New York, who was known for his convention-based poetry. Ernie Wesolowski was supposed to meet with them at Hiawatha, Kansas, and ride with them to the Indianapolis convention, but his parents wanted him to take the train, which he did. Upon arrival at the convention, he got an emergency message to call home immediately. The news was of a head-on collision on U.S. 36 near Macon, Missouri, at 7 in the morning. Marv was thrown out of the car and was the sole survivor. The other three conventioners passed away in that accident. Born in Cleveland, Ohio, he came to the area in the 1970s from Tampa, Florida. He was a U.S. Army veteran of the Korean War, a retired teacher, and member of the Immaculate Heart of Mary Catholic Church in Candler, Florida. Marv would have been 79 years old this past New Year's Eve. And another notable death that happened recently, he was not a ham or a DXer, but legendary radio announcer Fred Foy was known for his booming, passionate lead-ins to the Lone Ranger radio and television series, and he died Wednesday, December the 22nd, of natural causes in his Woburn, Massachusetts home. According to his daughter Nancy Foy, her father worked as an actor before landing the job as the announcer and narrator on the Lone Ranger radio show in 1948. He's best remembered for the show's lead-in that introduced the masked cowboy hero and his trusty horse with the line, "A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty hi-yo silver, the Lone Ranger." According to radio historian Jim Harmon, Foy's dramatic introduction and narration, performed in a powerful baritone voice, was so good it made many people forget there were others before him. Harmon called Foy perhaps the greatest announcer and narrator in the history of radio drama. Foy was born in Detroit, Michigan in 1921 and graduated from that city's Eastern High School in 1938 and landed an announcing job on the staff of radio station WXYZ in Detroit in 1942. He was drafted into the Army that year and served in the Armed Forces Radio Unit in Cairo during World War II. Foy returned to WXYZ in 1945. 3 years later, he won the job on The Lone Ranger, even stepping into the lead role for one radio broadcast when actor Bruce Beamer had laryngitis. Foy also performed on other classic radio series, including The Green Hornet and Sergeant Preston of the Yukon. In 1960, Foy began working for the ABC network. He spent 5 years as the announcer on The Dick Cavett Show and narrated documentaries. He left ABC in the mid-1980s and later retired. Fred Foy is survived by his wife of 63 years, Frances Foy, three grandchildren, and three great-grandchildren. He was 89 years old. Our final story on Side 1 has to do with counterfeit products. Counterfeit products have become a very serious concern for all manufacturers. Watches, clothes, CDs, televisions, and even radios are being cloned by unscrupulous manufacturers overseas. Now, some are easy to spot, such as RCA being RGA, except they use the same font and image as the real RCA logo. Still, others are blatant rip-offs, making the product appear by all indications to be a major manufacturer's product. Counterfeiting can hurt the reputation of a company, especially when the inferior product fails to live up to the advertised claims. It hurts distributors and sellers of equipment, as they now have to contend with an angry public due to the bad products and lack of sales due to a tarnished image. Counterfeit products are often sold at very, very low prices to attract interest. But the low cost is usually born from inferior quality control and performance. It can also be a safety matter because products will often be compromised to save money. Take, for example, a power cord. Your standard power cord is UL approved, which has undergone some rigorous testing. The counterfeit product could be made so cheaply that a person is shocked due to cracks in insulation, or in some cases, a short has occurred, leading to a fire. DXers and radio listeners have experienced electrocution from poorly designed counterfeit knockoffs. Fake transceivers, battery packs, chargers, and microphones have been reported in 2010. ICOM, a manufacturer of amateur radio equipment, is one such company that's fighting counterfeits. Their model V8 handheld is a product counterfeiters have recently cloned and successfully sold to an unwitting public on Craigslist and eBay. The difference in the radios are so small that a blind radio user might not know that they're using a fake radio. For example, the number 2 key on the real IC-V8 is for the P-beep function. That's P, letter P, then the word beep. On the fake radio, number 2 is Vox, V-O-X. On the back of the radio, the serial number tag is black on the real radio and white on the fake radio. The F21 battery pack looks like an ICOM battery pack, but there are two differences. The fake does not have the ICOM logo, and the part number is BP208 instead of BP209N, which is the real ICOM battery. Another headache for ICOM is the HM133 microphone. The ICOM original is marked HM133, while the counterfeit is HM133V. An original HM133V is for other ICOM radios. If you find a ICOM product that you suspect may be counterfeit, ICOM would like to hear from you. You can contact ICOM at 2380 116th Avenue Northeast, Bellevue, Washington, 98004, or you can call them at area code 425-454-8155. Oh, we have one other bit of information I need to pass on. We now have a musings line. Are you ready to copy down the number? It's area code 419-741-0205. That's area code 419-741-0205. Again, please keep it brief and to the point so everyone has a chance to speak. Do not leave any personal information, address changes, or any club business on that number. And hopefully this number will stay intact for a long time. I think it will, because basically what we did is we bought a phone line. So we're back in business with Musings to the Members at area code 419-741-0205. Now it's time for the AM switch. Let's take it out to Los Angeles, California. Here's Dave Alpert.
Hi, it's the new guy, Dave Alpert, with the AM Switch on the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service. Let's start with AM Switch number 78-13, beginning with call letter changes. On 600 kilohertz, WBWL, Jacksonville, Florida, is now WBOB. 740 WJIG, Tullahoma, Tennessee, becomes WHMT. 980 WUUS, Rossville, Georgia, goes by WDYN now. And the new station on 1250 in Mesquite, Nevada, has been granted the call letters KACE. Two more new stations, 1340 in Wendell, Idaho, is KXSL. And 1400 in Middleburg, Idaho, will go by KXIV. On 1410, WRHB, Leesburg, Florida, becomes WQBQ. 1500, Isleta, New Mexico's KABR is now KMYN. And on 1540, Niles, Ohio's WRTK now is WYCL. CP's on the air, 730 WLTQ, Charleston, South Carolina, is now on with U1, 5,000 watts day, 103 watts night, raising their daytime power. 1360 WNGN, McCook, Nebraska, is now on with D1, 1,000 watts day, 0 watts at night, no change from a new tower. 1430 KLO, Ogden, Utah, now operating with U4, 25,000 watts day, 5,000 watts night. 1490 WRCE, Watkins Glen, New York. After building a new, shorter tower adjacent to their former structure, WRCE is now on with U1, 880 watts day and night. The old tower collapsed in December 2009, and they were operating at approximately 100 watts from a long wire antenna since last February. 1530 WENG in Englewood, Florida is on the air with U1, 1,000 watts day, a mighty 1 watt at night, adding night authorization. Actions from the FCC, 1,000 KTOK, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, CP granted for a power increase to U4, 5,800 watts day, 5,800 watts night. Their patterns, shapes are unaffected, only a slight increase in coverage area. 1080 KCNM, Saipan, CP granted for a power decrease to U1, 1,100 watts day and night, and they're relocating their transmitter site. 1380 KRCM, Shenandoah, Texas, CP granted for U1, 2,800 watts day, 60 watts at night. And 1470 WMGG, Egypt Lake, Florida, licensed for U1, 5,000 watts day, 500 night at Dunedin. WMGG had a CP for U2, 3,600 watts day, 800 night, moving to Egypt Lake. Then they applied for U2, 750 watts day, 800 watts night, which has been approved. Construction permit amendments, 910 KKSN, Vancouver, Washington, licensed for U4, 5,000 watts day and night. KKSN has a CP for U4, 2,600 watts day, 4,300 watts night, moving to the three-tower array of co-owned KFXX on 1080. This amendment requests U4, 3,300 watts day, 4,300 watts night at that site. And 1120 KTXW, Manor, Texas, new station, not yet on the air, has a CP for U4, 430 day, 143 watts night. This amendment requests more power, U4, 5,600 watts day, 153 at night. Applications, 650 WSRO, Ashland, Massachusetts, applies for U4, 1,500 watts day, 62 watts at night. 860 WDMG, Douglas, Georgia, applies for U1, 5,000 watts day, 39 watts night. 1190 WAFS, Atlanta, Georgia, applies for D4, 25,000 watts day, 0 watts night, critical hours, 25,000. 1250 KZDC, San Antonio, Texas, applies for U4, 25,000 watts day, 920 at night. And 1490 WSIP, Paintsville, Kentucky, applies to move their transmitter to the site of and diplex into the folded unipole antenna system of co-owned WKYH on 600 kilohertz. Application amendments, 1190 WPSP, Royal Palm Beach, Florida, licensed for U2, 690 watts day, 410 night. WPSP applied for U2, 410 watts day and night. This amendment requests U2, 2200 watts day, 2200 watts at night. Dismissals, 1060 WCOK, Sparta, Tennessee, licensed for D1, 800 watts day, 0 at night. WCOK first applied for D1, 1100 watts day, 0 night, then amended the application, adding 1100 watts during critical hours. That addition to the application has been dismissed, leaving WCOK with the initial application. AM on FM, 1280 WVXR in Moorhead, Minnesota, which already simulcasts with 1370 KWTL Fargo, North Dakota, being heard now on 91.3 Mandan, North Dakota, with a Catholic format. returning to the airwaves KOAN 1020 Eagle River, Alaska, with talk. Reported as silent, KZMX 580, Hot Springs, Arkansas. They went off on December 13th. Their silent STA application states, pipes underneath the station froze and began significant leaking, causing damage to the station equipment and resulting in the station being unable to continue broadcasting. While we hope to be able to minimize the damage, make necessary repairs so that employees can return within the next 30 days, we request silent authority in the abundance of caution. WBIS 1190 Annapolis, Maryland is silent, allowing WAGE 1200 Leesburg, Virginia to complete its upgrade and move to 1190. KBIS 1490 Forks, Washington reported off due to a lightning strike, and KUAU 1570 Haiku, Hawaii off due to water damage suffered from recent heavy rains. The feds have canceled a $7,000 fine issued to WWTM 1400 in Decatur, Alabama. Santa is alive. And this news item, dated December 15th, the borough of Crafton, Pennsylvania, has given the owners of WZUM 1590, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, 30 days to remove any equipment from the property where their three towers are located. After that happens, the towers will be raised. The station has been silent since last March, and it has been reported that the rent on the land has not been paid in several months. Our thanks to Wayne Heinen, Håkon Sundman, and Philip Zamanowski for the information. Now let's turn our attention to AM switch number 7814. Call letter changes. 570 KACP, Salt Lake City, Utah, is now KNRS. And 1590 WKHZ, Ocean City, Maryland, now goes by WMHZ. CP's on the air, 1240 KGY, Olympia, Washington, now on with U1, 1,000 watts day and night from a new 198-foot tall tower. 1260 KBSZ, Apache Junction, Arizona, CP for U1, 3,500 watts day, 50 watts at night, is on the air. One FCC action to report, 1470 KIID, Sacramento, California, operating under an STA with U1, 1250 watts day, 250 night. Since losing two of their three towers in July 2009 due to a grass fire, KIID has been granted a CP to reconstruct the two towers and revert to the original U4 5,000 watts day, 1,000 watts night facilities. The new towers will be slightly shorter, and the third remaining tower will be shortened to match the new ones to divest the painting and lighting requirements. Construction permit amendments. One to report, 980 KRTX. Rosenberg, Richmond, Texas, licensed for U2, 1,000 watts day, 4,000 watts night. KRTX applied for and received a CP for D3, 5,000 watts day, 0 watts at night. Yep, they forgot to stipulate a night power in the application, and they were granted what they asked for. Now they reapplied for U4, 5,000 watts day, 4,000 night. Be careful what you ask for. Applications, 790 WNIS, Norfolk, Virginia, applies for U4, 5,500 watts day, 5,000 night. 890 KQLX, Lisbon, North Dakota, applies for D1, 2,500 watts day, 0 watts night. Critical hours, 2,500 watts. And 930 KKXX, Paradise, California, operating U1, 1,000 watts daytime, 37 watts at night. KKXX lost most of their ground system to vandalism last October. They are proposing to replace the ground system with six 264-foot wires spaced 60 degrees around the base of the tower, tapered approximately 30 degrees from ground level to posts 12 to 15 feet above ground. 1240 KCLV, Clovis, New Mexico, applies for U1, 900 watts, day and night, from a new, taller tower. And WCED, Dubois, Pennsylvania, 1420, applies for U1, 4200 watts day, 5 watts at night, decreasing both day and night power levels, plus eliminating their night directional operation. AM on FM, 760 KGU, Honolulu, Hawaii, now heard on KGU FM 99.5 and 1450 KMRY, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, now also being heard on FM Translator, K227BL 93.3 in Anamosa, Iowa. Dismissals, 830 WFGM, Sandy Springs, Georgia. The license for this unbuilt station has been canceled. 810 WKVM, San Juan, Puerto Rico. Application to move to a new site dismissed per applicant's request. 1060 WCOK, Sparta, North Carolina. Licensed for D1, 800 watts day, 0 watts night. WCOK first applied for D1, 1100 watts day, 0 watts night, then amended the application, adding 1,100 watts critical hours. That addition to the application has been dismissed, leaving WCOK with the initial application. 1120 WZME, Richmond, Maine. License for this unbuilt station has been canceled. And the license for 1340 KACE, Bishop, California has been canceled. Returning to the airwaves, WOAM 1350 Peoria, Illinois, back on the air with standards, at least temporarily, according to John Clemmer. WVHF 1140 Kentwood, Michigan, returns with Catholic programming from the Holy Family Radio Network. Reported as silent, WSHN 1550 in Fremont, Michigan. Fines, an $8,000 cumulative fine has been assessed Zimmer Radio, licensee of KZRG 1310 and KZYM 1230, Joplin, Missouri, plus four FM stations, for violating the FCC's Equal Employment Opportunity Rules by failing to comply with the recruitment, self-assessment, and public file requirements. A $20,000 cumulative fine has been assessed Opus Broadcasting Systems, Inc., licensee of KRTA 610 and KEZX 730, Medford, Oregon, plus two FM stations, for failing to comply with the FCC's EEO requirements. And our thanks to Wayne Heinen for information on AM switch number 7814. Now let's send the virtual microphone to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Bruce Winkleman has some tests for us for the month of February. Bruce?
On Saturday, February 12th, at precisely 1 a.m. and 2 a.m. Central Standard Time, that's 0700 and 0800 UTC, KHMO 1070 in Hannibal, Missouri, will conduct a DX test for us. The test will be with Morse code, sweep tones, and voice announcements for 5 minutes at the top of the first hour, with its 5-kilowatt, 3-tower day pattern, and then 5 minutes at the top of the second hour at its 1-kilowatt, 6-tower night power. Also on Saturday, February 12th, from 3 a.m. to 4 a.m. Central Standard Time, that's 0900 to 0100 UTC, WLIQ 1530 in Quincy, Illinois, will conduct a DX test. WLIQ will test for 20 minutes using Morse code, sweep tones, voice announcement, special music, sound bites, etc., at its 1400 watts non-directional day power. Then WLIQ will test for 20 minutes at 290 watts non-directional critical hours power. Finally, for the last 20 minutes of the hour, they will test at 3 watts, non-directional night power. Our third and last test is on Saturday, February 19th. This test will be from 1 a.m. to 2 a.m. Central Standard Time. That's 0700 to 0800 UTC. WLRB 1510, Macon, Illinois, will conduct a test. The WLRB test for the first 30 minutes we'll use Morse code, sweep tones, voice announcements, special music, sound bites, etc., and it will be at 1 kilowatt non-directional day power. For the second half of the test, the content will be the same, but the power will be reduced to 250 watts non-directional critical hours power. If you would like to receive a QSL, you can send a written report or a cassette or CD to the chief engineer at the following address: Gary Glanzer, in care of the DX test station you're reporting on the next line, 325 East Douglas Avenue, Jacksonville, Illinois, 62650. Tapes or CDs will be accepted along with written reports, but must be queued up to the point of where the best reception is. If sending in a report by mail, you must include a returned, self-addressed, stamped envelope if you expect to get a QSL or any reply. The reports are being sent to the engineer's home address, not the station. So please be patient, as Mr. Glanzer is the chief engineer for 16 radio stations in Missouri and Illinois. EQSLs are available. Send to the engineer at glanzer@frontier.com with both the station call letters and the words DX test in the subject line. Finally, we ask that you please not telephone any of the stations or the engineer during the test. No one will be at the stations during the tests, and everything is being done remotely by phone control. Of course, be sure to report any catches to us here at the DX Audio Service, and include some audio as well. And finally, please help the cause by forwarding this test information far and wide, and if you can, organize a test of your own. Contact us here at the DX Audio Service on how you can do it. For more information on DX tests, contact Saul Chernos at 57 Berkeley Street, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, M5A2W5. Or you can email Saul at sauldx@simpatico.ca. For the DX Audio Service, this is Bruce Winkleman.
Thanks, Bruce, and may I add my voice to welcome you and Dave Alpert to our merry band of editors and contributors. Your longtime love for radio and interest in DXing is going to help us make the DX Audio Service an even better publication, and we'll certainly appreciate your contributions.
National Radio Club.
Gosh, here it is February already, and seems like we just turned the corner on a new year. Good time to sort out some of the upcoming band scan topics and to continue to fulfill requests for subject matter. Over the past several installments, we've been bringing you full dial band scans as heard through a monopole low noise antenna that we've been moving from state to state. We covered all the stations in South Dakota, most of them in Wyoming on a trip west last fall. Next in that series is a non-directional band scan covering most of the Utah stations. And then we'll branch out to other states as you request. But now it's time to take a short break from band scans to dig into the promised series, The State of the Station. This group of broadcasts will illuminate the pioneer radio stations, most of which came on the air during the early 1920s, and see how they developed their facilities over the years. We can do that thanks to extensive records available on microfiche from the FCC through the efforts of Zen Scott, an avid radio enthusiast. Most of our old-timers know that by the 1930s, most of the big stations had settled in with their high-power systems, and except for the 1941 NARBA frequency reassignment and some minor changes resulting from the Rio treaties of 40 years later, there weren't a lot of changes or upgrades after the initial startup mayhem until the FCC opened it up again in recent years. So those stations are covered, but it was at the other lower-powered stations that most of the action occurred over the past half century. The FCC has reclassified their earlier stepped power levels, which were 1 kilowatt and then 5 and then 10 and 25 and 50, and allowed stations to operate with intermediate powers and specialized antennas for a better fit. And the result, while seemingly adding to the chaos on the band, actually went a long way toward solidifying coverage for many of those regionals and made them more predictable targets for DXers. Well, the devil is in the details, and I'm not really sure how this is going to work out for you, but we're going to try to put our toes into the water for a couple of columns and ask you to provide the feedback we'll need to keep going or stop the series. Of course, we hope the information is of interest, but if it's not, we'd like it if you'd tell us. So off we go. Not necessarily in any particular order, but finding stations here and there that we can talk about. And let's start with KTHS, Hot Springs, Arkansas, and how it seemed to be tied to the Dallas-Fort Worth market. Or to use another title, the strange switchies of 1040 and 1060. Trust me, this is going to be complicated. I'll do my best to explain a very convoluted situation involving several stations that were interweaved by fortune and poor thinking by the federal radio guys.
I guess we all recall that WBAP and WFAA swapped time and frequencies in Dallas, but did you know that very early on, WBAP shared time with KTHS in Arkansas? In fact, there's a fascinating early relationship between the Dallas stations and KTHS, now KAAY. And by the way, we're going to speak in frequencies rather than wavelengths to keep this simple and consistent. WBAP and WFAA had originally been licensed for 630 kilocycles. Within a few months, they had been moved to 600 sharing time. It turned out to be an on-again, off-again relationship. Late in 1928, WBAP moved to 800 with 5 kilowatts. And now, WBAP was sharing time with KTHS, which had moved from 780 to 800. Now, KRLD Dallas, after flirting with 890, had come on the air on 650 in mid-1927. They were sharing time with WRR Dallas. KRLD was moved to 1040 in early 1928. Well, the plot grows more confusing, folks. WFAA had gone from 630 to 600 to 550, and in 1928 was told to move to 1040. But there they would have to timeshare that channel with KRLD. This early frequency shuffling is very typical of the reports, as you'll hear in coming months. In the early days, particularly in the first 2 or 3 years of operation, and up until about 1930, it wasn't unusual for stations to be on 4 or 5 different frequencies. To the detriment of the listeners, of course. Then in early 1929, KTHS also moved to 1040, where it now shared time with KRLD and WFAA. While KTHS was at 10 kilowatts, WFAA had been given a permit to build out 50 kilowatts to attain parity with WBAP. So in 1929, we had KTHS and KRLD WFAA together on 1040. WFAA went to 800 and thus began its long-time sharing arrangement with WBAP. More on that in just a minute. So back to our story. We had WFAA and WBAP on 800, and now KTHS and KRLD sharing 1040. And all was fine, and the listeners could finally find their programs. Not. The FCC file shows that KTHS was granted an unusual variance in 1929, permission to move to 970 temporarily during the World Series games. Presumably, they would have otherwise had to yield the channel to KRLD during game times. KTHS, over the following years, seemed to have a love affair with 970. They requested the frequency for other special broadcasts. One that stands out is a request to use 970 for the Atwater Kent receiver demonstration of October 31st, 1931. I couldn't make this up, folks. Well, this request was denied, but they were given the channel for daytime broadcasts on New Year's Day and were increasingly requesting 970 for special daytime hours. It was obvious the KRLD-KTHS 1040 sharing wasn't working out. KTHS received permission to operate on 1060 daytime. Interestingly, they were required to go silent on 1060 from local sunset until 8 p.m. Central Time. They solved that problem by installing one of the newly developed directional antenna system to protect WBAL. Well, meanwhile, back in Dallas, with the KTHS change to 1060, KRLD was now able to operate full-time at 50 kilowatts on 1040. But they, too, had to install a directional antenna to protect WTIC. In the end, KTHS ended up on 1090 in 1941 and morphed into the legendary music station of the South, and fielded a magnificent array of rockers, as well as the iconic Beaker Street with Clyde Clifford. The call KTHS was heard until 1962, when the station began identifying as KAAY. Remember WRR Dallas? They ended up on 1310, became KAAM for a while, and are now known as KTCK. And what of WTIC and WBAL? Well, WTIC at this earlier time was on 860, but they were doing some swapping with WEEI that took them to 630 for experimental purposes, according to the record. WTIC went to 650 for a short time, then back to 630 with a stop at 560, where they shared time with WCAC. This whole thing makes me sweat. This timeshare on 560 then went to 600. Well, WTIC prepared an application for 50,000 watts on 1060, where they shared time with, ready, WBAL. It's almost incestuous, isn't it? Well, that didn't make much sense to either East Coast station. So in 1934, WTIC began experimental authorization on 1040, sharing, as we know, with KRLD, with both on the air full-time. The change became permanent in 1940, just a year before they had to move again to 1080. A WTIC directional antenna system was designed to protect KRLD, the reciprocal protection, but, interestingly, did not have to operate until sunset Dallas time. This unusual authorization has survived. KRLD, on the other hand, had been told to protect WTIC day and night, but that was changed to night-only directional operation. However, unlike WTIC, KRLD has to switch at local sunset, as do all other stations. WTIC was also not averse to trying new ideas. The record shows they held an authorization for operation on 660 to try synchronizing with WEAF in New York. In the mid-30s, WTIC also did some experimenting with shortwave relay systems, proving the feasibility of long-range high-quality reception and helping lay the groundwork for the technology for overseas news reporting via shortwave. WBAL, meanwhile, came up on 1220, moved to 1050, and in 1928 to 1060, sharing time, as we said, with WTIC. In the early 1930s, WBAL received a synchronization license, so they could operate on WJZ's frequency of 760 during the hours when 1060 was being covered by WTIC. Oh my, it was a clever way to avoid major interference along the East Coast, but it sure made it difficult for the listeners. But things were getting better. A short time later, WTIC moved to 1040, and now WBAL had to contend with KTHS in Arkansas, which had just moved to its channel. Directional antennas and the 1941 NARBA did the rest. Now, of course, WTIC and KRLD share 1080 with many other stations, while KTHS and WBAL share 1090. There was one interesting authorization that turned up in WBAL's wartime operation. We read from the FCC authorization of 1943. WBAL granted authority to operate with non-directional antenna during such periods when it is necessary to transmit air raid signals and air raid test signals, only in compliance with orders from First Fighter Command, in order to ensure maximum efficiency from WBAL as a key alerting station. That may have been the first example of nighttime operation not conforming to the regular license, which idea, we know, seems to accidentally occur on many local nighttime stations during high school sports season. And the rest, as they say, is history. The station jumping between 1040 and 1060 must have driven listeners crazy and certainly added gray hair to the DXers. And now quickly, the conclusion of the WFAA-WBAP story. In 1932, WBAP began to operate with WFAA's transmitter. Since they were time-sharing 800, this was a piece of cake, just changed the wires. A few years later, the stations were allowed to jointly identify as WFAA-WBAP Dallas. WFAA and WBAP got 50 kilowatts in steps on 800, where they would stay until 1941 when NARBA moved them to 820. Now 570 enters the picture. Go get a glass of water and we'll continue. In 1938, WBAP had had enough of time-sharing 800 with WFAA, and its owner moved in a station on 570 from Wichita Falls. A few years later, the timeshare took on a new twist. During the time WBAP was on 820 at 50 kilowatts, WFAA operated on 570 at 5 kilowatts, and the calls switched back and forth during day parts. Although historians note that the radio networks didn't shift with the call letters. In other words, NBC stayed on the 800 or 820 spot regardless of the station call at the time, while ABC would be heard on 570, regardless of which station was operating there at the time. And then finally, in 1970, WBAP had a new owner and full-time solo operation on 820, while WFAA stayed full-time at 570. Those 570 call letters changed a few times, and 570 at one point ended up as the home of Cliff, KLIF, the legendary rocker that had been heard on the 1190 frequency. WBAP, of course, continues its powerhouse full-service programming on 820 to 35 states. And that, folks, is more than enough for our inaugural broadcast of the State of the Station series. If you made it through this one, you can easily handle the stories we're preparing for the development of others. And next month, we visit Alaska and the Pacific Northwest to learn about some of the stations that began life to serve those areas. As we said at the outset, we're here to provide information. So if you like or don't like this sort of occasional column, please let us know by the musings line or by comments to Fred or myself. I can be reached by email at mark4@dernberger.com, and I'll spell that Mark with a K, the number 4, at Dernberger, DURENBERGER.com. And now let's flip over the tape to side two.
This sounds like a very good idea to me. Good plan.
One voice is clear.
Wicked!